wanted a chance to make law. Well, here it is. Make it a good one.
Is this your gun?
No.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
We have your name on the registration.
No, you don't.
Don't be ridiculous. Networks don't get to decide elections. Courts do.
Your Honors, I'm not some slick big city lawyer like my opponent here.
What just happened? You kind of confessed. Sorry.
And I find you guilty. Bring out the wheel of punishment!
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 465, and I'm Thomas, and that's Andrew. How are you doing, sir?
I am fantastic, Thomas. How are you? Still not a cat.
Still not a cat. And we are not talking about He Who Shall Not Be Named. I'm excited for what is sure to be a classic OA deep dive, the way the show should have been in the alternate universe where Hillary was president or something. So I can't wait. Let's see. I don't even think we have any announcements or anything.
No, I can't. I can't wait. Let's get to it.
All right. Here we go. Down the law, breaking down the law, breaking down the law, breaking down the law. Andrew, how do we unionize Amazon?
Well, we are getting a masterclass in that right now from a union called the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union. And this is super fascinating, right? So strap in. You're going to learn about the National Labor Relations Act. I learned so much researching the story. And those are always the most fun for me to bring to you, because I get to share the stuff that I didn't know. So I knew that Amazon was one of the largest employers in the United States. They are the second largest employer. They employ 800,000 people, of whom almost all are classified as essential workers. That is, they have been working throughout this pandemic. I teased this last week. I didn't know this at all. Like, Amazon has fulfillment centers across Europe. Virtually all of their employees not in the United States are unionized.
Oh, well, then I bet it's $4,000 to deliver you a sign, you know, like, or are you going to tell me it actually works out okay and Amazon is
Yeah, still- it works out just fine. Okay. Amazon has had, as far as I can tell, one vote as to whether any element of its workforce would unionize. And I'm going to explain the minutiae on that in a minute. It was in 2014, and it lost. It was a group of mechanics and technicians who worked in a Delaware facility for Amazon. So, Thomas, I don't expect you to get the margin. I just wanted looking for, you know, sort of the total vote total here. How many people do you think voted, Amazon employees voted in that 2014 election?
Am I looking for a percentage or am I looking for a number?
Yeah, number. Total so number of votes.
Out of 800,000 people, potentially.
Right.
3,412.
Yeah. So the vote was 21 to 6.
Wait, what? Jeez, that's even worse. I thought I understood.
I knew you were going to be like, it's either going to be really big or really small.
Talk about porked exams.
Yeah. It was. So the way that it works under the National Labor Relations Act is that if you are a union and you have an identifiable subpopulation of an employer's workforce, and that is called a bargaining unit, and you say, I think these guys all have the same interests in common, and you get 30% of them to sign a letter, then you can petition the National Labor Relations Board to hold an election of the entire bargaining unit. And if they vote greater than 50%, then you get to go in and be the union that represents them. So an issue that is frequently debated in NLRB cases is what's a relevant bargaining unit, right? And you can imagine that, like, for purposes of certain unions, you might want to treat different Amazon subpopulations differently, right? Like, the drivers may have different mm-hmm. interests than the stockers, and right. they both and they have do. Very different interests, yeah, than management, right?
Yeah.
So put a pin in that. The only vote that Amazon has ever had in its entire history in the United States, whether to unionize, that was authorized by the NLRB and overseen, right, in accordance with the National Labor Relations Act, was for the International Associations of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. And it was whether to have this tiny group of mechanics and technicians that worked at their Delaware facility authorize the IAMAW to represent them. And they voted that down 21-6 7 years ago, January 15th, 2014, a little over 7 years ago. If you ask Amazon, well, kind of seems like 27 votes out of 800,000 seems low.
Statistically, right? Insignificant sample size, yeah. Like, honestly. Yeah.
Right. And their argument is, we're good to our workers, right? We in 2018, we passed a $15 an hour minimum wage across the company. So you don't need to unionize, right? And that is the position that they have taken very publicly. In opposition to that, you might point out a number of different things. The first thing you would probably point out are conditions on the job. So put a pin in that. We'll come back to that one. But you also might unionize so that individuals aren't forced to sign take-it-or-leave-it contracts that have what is a blatantly unenforceable non-compete agreement, right? That is, 18 months after you quit or fired by Amazon, you can't work in any competitive business anywhere in the world. Don't take legal advice from a podcast, but there's no way that's enforceable. Non-competing agreements are meant to prevent you from taking legitimate techniques that you have learned at your prior employer and, you know, using them on behalf of your next employer for stacking shelves that, you know, is
yeah,
just
in
not.
Another company, they put the shelves on top of the things, but in Amazon, they put the things on top of the shelf. You can't take that important trade secret.
Yeah. That's right. And in addition to the non-competes, one of the reasons I had to dig a lot to figure out where those contracts are, and my source is The Verge, which is not, you know, not a top line source for me usually, is because in that same contract are non-disclosure agreements, right? Mm. So one of the counter arguments of why you might want a union is, hey, you have an employer that is trying to curtail outside knowledge about its employment conditions. And we'll talk about the conditions, but as a result of that, in September of 2020, reports surfaced. And then the reason they surfaced is because somebody was scanning, you know, job sites, right? And online, not facilities, but like online web portals for new jobs. And Amazon tried to hire an intelligence analyst. Mm. And that job posting went viral. Amazon was asked about it and they said, oh, we posted that in error. But the idea was to have somebody who would oversee their efforts to figure out if employees were unionizing or not. So that job went unfilled. But what did not was, I will link it in the show notes, that Amazon is using both from its corporate headquarters and installed on its employees' desktops, sophisticated software that spies on what its employees are doing off the job, right, in closed Facebook groups and other online organizing. And that software delivers a report back to corporate identifying, among other things, drivers who, quote, were planning to strike or to protest against Amazon, end of quote, or participated in Facebook groups that had certain code words within the Facebook groups that were linked to potential labor organization, right? And those code words were things like fair wage, right? Which, by the way, yeah, we talk about fair wage in our Facebook community all the time, right? So if you work for Amazon and you're a member of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, you may have gotten a report about you.
Holy shit.
Yeah, sent back to Amazon corporate. And The Guardian, September 27th of last year, published an expose. Amazon owns, among many, many other things, they own the Whole Foods chain of grocery stores. And a secret training video leaked out from Amazon corporate post-merger explaining to Whole Foods how to prevent their workforce from unionizing. They're very fine people on both sides. So we wanted to present the full, you know, maybe no one ever unionizes at Amazon because the pay is fantastic and the working conditions are great, or maybe because the company has made it a top priority in the United States to persuade its employees not to unionize. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. But put a pin in all that stuff for the time being. Now I want to tell you about the specific outfit that's going on right now. On March 29th of 2020, so right as the pandemic was taking hold, pandemic has been super good for Amazon's business, right? As we all know, right?
Yeah.
So they opened a brand new facility. It is called the BHM1 facility in a town called Bessemer, Alabama, and it has 6,000 plus employees. The conditions in this fulfillment center are, I'm going to quote from the American Prospect, but I have multiple sources on this. Let's start off with Sarah Marie Thrasher, who says, quote, "They work you to death." Hmm. She worked as a stower, an employee who stocks items in warehouses before they're ordered by customers, right? So she offloads from trucks, stores them in the warehouse before they have to go out as purchase. She worked there for 2 months, 7 weeks, October and November of 2020, before being fired by email with no prior warning. Ms. Thrasher says, "It's crowded. Sometimes you can't even find a station. We would get reprimanded if our stowing time was above 20 seconds or higher, with rates needed to be done in 8 seconds per item." Thrasher explained that bathroom breaks were available, but taking one would negatively impact your stowing rate. And if there were no stowing stations available, she would be placed in different departments without any training. So she's there putting packages away. You're allowed to go to the bathroom, yeah. But at the end of the day, they figure out. Yeah. Well, we've seen reports that it was prohibited, and this is a way of effectively prohibiting it. If they take total number of packages divided by total amount of time you're on the job, and going to the bathroom counts as being on the job, you can see how that would be bad. I'll give you another former stower. Byron Tollison worked there from August to October of 2020. Said starting wage of $15 an hour was enticing, but the work environment was awful. Quote, "It was almost set up like a sweatshop. Turnover rate is extremely high, where we would have at least 50 new people coming through every 2 weeks." Okay, so that's the reports from inside the facility. And what happened? What happened is that the retail, wholesale, and department store union decided to target a subset, like the stowers part of that, a subset of the people who worked at this BHM1 facility. And what you have to do, as I said before, under 29 USC section 159E, is you've got to get 30% of the relevant workforce of the bargaining unit to sign your petition. And once you get over 30%, you can then, under the law, deliver it to the National Labor Relations Board. And what they do is they immediately send notice to the employer. They say, hey, we've got a petition. Here's what it is. And we're going to hear from both of you. And then we're going to decide if this is something where we are required by the law, by the National Labor Relations Act, to hold a vote. And if we're required to hold a vote, then that will be by secret ballot, and it will be administered by the NLRB, so as to be fair. I'm going to link, this is the NLRB's own reports that go back from 2010 to 2019. And although union activity is way down in 2019, which maybe you could infer is a Trump thing. Otherwise, the activity is relatively constant and the ratios are relatively similar. Okay. And it looks something like this. You would have petitions like this filed about 2,000 per year. Of those 2,000, a tiny handful get dismissed on motions to dismiss. How do they get dismissed on a motion to dismiss? If you don't have enough signatures, right? If there's some kind of technical defect. And when I say a tiny fraction, I mean, you know, in 2018, 17 of them. The most in the past decade was 2011 when 43 were dismissed, right? So a tiny, tiny fraction, 1 to 2% every year get dismissed. A rather large fraction are withdrawn. About a quarter, a third to a quarter of these petitions are withdrawn every year. And I wanted to figure out kind of how that happened. And that's what got me down the rabbit trail to this Amazon case. So now let's go back. On November 20th of 2020, after spending some time. So facility, the BHM-1 facility opens up March 29th of 2020. You could imagine how difficult it is to get those workers to like come over and sign your petition, right? During COVID. But the retail, wholesale, and department store union assembled, they defined the stowers, the people they wanted to represent. They wanted to exclude truck drivers, seasonal employees, temporary employees, supervisors, managers, right? So they defined their relevant bargaining unit at 1,500 people. So under the law, they need 30%. They need 450 signatories. And they got that by November 20th. And so the NLRB sends out a letter and says, hey, we've received a petition, appears valid on its face, has the requisite number of signatures. Amazon, what's your response? And then Amazon did something that employers typically do. And this is a weird sort of double or nothing, but it makes sense to me. They said, oh, the 1,500 people, that's not a sensible bargaining unit. It should be all of our employees.
Are they just trying to make like it's impractical to get all of the employees or how? What is this gambit?
The reason that you would do that is think about once the union has defined its own bargaining unit, they have to get 30% to file the petition, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, you got 1,500 people. You've already signed up 450 people. To win the election, you only need to get to 750, right? So you only need to persuade 300 more people. If Amazon can expand out the number of people who are eligible to vote, then you need to persuade 3,000 people instead of 300. And it turns out that this is, in fact, a fairly common tactic that employers use. They say, hey, relevant pool should be much larger. And all of these other people should be eligible to vote. And then they are allowed to have in-person meetings at the company that says, okay, you're going to hear from a union, but here's all the reasons why you shouldn't join a union. Okay. So they can then start lobbying their own people not to join the union. The RWDSU, the union, called their bluff. And they said, okay, sure. You want to put the entire population, right? The entire workforce of 6,000 people at this facility up for a vote. We'll take that vote. Absolutely. So then and I think Amazon was kind of surprised by that. So then the argument shifted to, well, what kind of a vote should we have? Tell me if this strikes you as familiar at all. The union wanted to have vote by mail. Right? Their view was, well, we got a goddamn pandemic going on. Voting by mail is a long recognized procedure at the NLRB. And let's do that.
Can't even just set something up online or something.
So here's the thing. It, again, these are overseen by the NLRB, right? So as you might imagine, because, you know, well, it's not hard to imagine one that would be grotesquely unfair, right? Like a thing where you get a, you can either put your ballot in the yes box or the no box, and your boss sits up at the front of the room.
Yeah.
Right. So NLRB has to oversee it. I don't know if they have done it online. They're not doing it online in this case. I would be a little bit worried about hacking, but yeah, it's worth kind of putting a pin in that and looking for ways to modernize it. Amazon thought differently. Amazon said, no. Look, there's all kinds. The rates are, the response rates are lower, and there are more errors, and there's more, you know, fraudulent ballots.
Yeah.
Let's have an in-person
plus, voting. You know, Russia's probably trying to tamper with our union vote over here.
You betray the law!
Exciting announcement. Every week, we're doing an extra opening arguments. You know how? We're going to be on the Stereo app Wednesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. We're going to be on the Stereo app answering your questions, and you're going to be a part of the show. I am so excited for it.
Yeah, this is going to be a lot of fun. The Stereo app is really cool. What you do is you download the app, you sign up, look for me. I am at Torres, T-O-R-R-E-Z. Thomas is at SiriusPod, and you'll get the little notifications of when we're about to go live, and you can talk to us live and ask us questions. So, you know, we're looking for ways to increase that interactivity with you. This is not replace our monthly Q&As. We're going to continue to do that. But this is just us being able to get out, bring you more of the show, bring you that content, and have you interact with us live.
But this is exclusive to the Stereo app. So you got to get on that. Go find that at your app store, whatever app store you use. I am so excited to hear from you. You guys get to be a part of the show. Ask us whatever. There are so many issues. There's even more stuff to cover now than ever. You know, in a weird way, you know, people were worried what we talk about after Trump, but without that clown horn clogging up the Twitterverse, there's even more cool stuff to talk about.
Absolutely. So make sure you join us over on Stereo. That is every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific on the Stereo app. Look for me. I'm at Torres. Look for Thomas at SiriusPod, or just start searching for opening arguments. You will come across it, and we'd love to see you there. I'm going to read you what Amazon proposed.
Uphill in the snow both ways.
Yeah. The employer proposes the parking lot adjacent to the facility as the voting location. The employer asserts that it can erect a tent equipped with heating and lighting to cover 3,600 square feet. The size of the tent may be adjusted as needed or desired, and the sides may be raised or lowered to control the flow of fresh air. Voting would take place between 6 a.m. and 11 a.m. and between 1 p.m. and 6 p.m. for up to 4 days. In addition to providing all requested health certification and personal protective equipment, the employer is willing to make free COVID testing available to election participants, to conduct temperature screening using thermoscan technology, to make its digital distance assistant or human social distancing team available to monitor the line leading to the voting tent, to provide pass-through boxes or vending machines to ensure that ballot distribution is contactless, provide restroom trailers so that the board agents need not enter the employer's facility, arrange for food delivery services that would be at a separate tent so that the voting area and board agents need not seek meals elsewhere, arrange for board agent transportation to the location using drivers who have received negative COVID tests, arrange for a private independently sanitized floor or wing of a local hotel for board agents staying in the area overnight, and or arrange for board agents who wish to stay on site in recreational vehicles during the course of the election.
So that sounds like a huge pain.
That sounds like an amazing pain to not just mail out the ballots, which is what the union suggested happen. Mm-hmm.
Well, who gets to decide? I mean, if the union says one thing and the company, I don't even know why the company has a say in how the people might get to vote about how to unionize. Is that just because of the capitalistic nightmare hellscape we live in, or?
It has to do with a prior decision of the NLRB called Aspirus Kiwanaw, which was a November 2020 decision about how to hold elections during the pandemic. And it basically says that it's up to the NLRB to make a decision as to how to implement the requirements of voting in a way that's consistent with protecting employees. So it isn't that the employer, you know, gets to say, it's that they make dueling proposals and they argue, you know, to the NLRB which one you should choose. By the way, this is why it's important who sits on the NLRB, right?
Yeah.
You know, you can imagine that different folks may view this differently based on your based on the overwhelming similarities that this has to the position taken by the two major parties. And in fact, the NLRB held in another decision called Daylight Transport from August of 2020, that concerns about potential disenfranchisement of voters could be relevant to whether a mail ballot election is appropriate. So in other words, the kinds of arguments that are being raised against voting by mail have been looked on in some cases favorably by the NLRB. And so here, this is not great that their primary objection to the mail ballot election being raised by Amazon was that it would not be able to, quote, hold certain employee meetings at any time within 24 hours of when the ballots are mailed until the ballots are counted. The employer argues that this unfairly gives the petitioner, the union, a greater opportunity to communicate with employees where the employer has ceased holding large in-person meetings. The NLRB, in reviewing that rather dryly, says, I note that the employer has ceased holding large in-person meetings for the same reason that a manual election is inappropriate, namely a pandemic. I further note that many methods of digital communication are available in equal measure to the employees, the petitioner, and the employer. So I gave away kind of the conclusion there while reading, but the NLRB rejected those arguments. And they said, no, you're going to have a vote-by-mail election.
Oh, good.
And that vote by mail election began last Monday, February 8th. Ooh. And if you're thinking, like, how does an independent body that is trying to make sure that voters aren't disenfranchised to hold the freest, fairest elections possible, your ballot must be received in an envelope that is signed. Okay. If not, it's void and you get a notice that says your ballot was thrown out. But the ballots must be returned to the National Labor Relations Board Region 10 office by the close of business on Monday, March 29th, 2021. So 7 weeks of voting is what an independent, nonpartisan body trying to count the ballots of 6,000 people decided was appropriate to sort of balance out those concerns. And it has begun, and we're gonna track it, because this would be the very first inroads of any union in any Amazon facility whatsoever. So really, really exciting. Amazon is allowed to communicate with its employees during the election, right? There is not the equivalent of the no electioneering rules, right? Like when you're in line. Yeah. Amazon is communicating with its employees.
There should be the equivalent of no electioneering rules.
I think that's right. So here's who's eligible to vote. All employees at the facility who have worked an average of 4 hours or more per week during the 13 weeks immediately preceding the eligibility date for the election, right? That is February 8th. So part-time employees as well as full-time employees. They vote whether they wish to be represented for purposes of collective bargaining by the retail, wholesale, and department store union. If that fails, right, they can try and organize again with a different unit. But it would obviously, you see the expense the union has had to go to get to this point, it would be a significant deterrent if they, you know, wind up losing. And you'd have to go back to the beginning and get all the signatures and everything else. In the meantime, Amazon has engaged in a bunch of different ways in which it wants to communicate with its workers about the dangers of joining a union. So flyers posted in the bathrooms. Okay, that seems fine, right? Like you get to put up a little letter that says, hey,
employees aren't using them anyway. So,
right.
Why are you posting stuff in the bathroom? You don't allow your employees to go to the bathroom. So fine, post away.
Yeah. How about mandatory meetings? Sometimes as often as 5 times a day to argue about why unions would be worse off. You'd be worse off with the unions. They've launched a website called Do It Without Dues. I want a quote from that website. Quote. Great.
Anti-union propaganda is the best. Here we go.
Yeah. Why pay almost $500 in dues? We've got you covered with high wages, healthcare, vision, and dental benefits, as well as a safety committee and an appeals process. Mind you, the benefits only apply to the full-time employees.
I was going
to
say, cool, where are these high wages and healthcare and all whatever those? Where is that? How do I get that? Yeah.
But again, right, the same perverse incentive that underlies, you know, the Affordable Care Act, right, is that young workers making, and here, $15 an hour, which should be minimum wage, people making minimum wage, people at the margin, overvalue the take-home pay because so much of it has to go to fixed expenses, like, you know, food and shelter. So saying your paycheck is going to go down $500 to somebody making $15 an hour is a pretty strong argument. A little bit of some reports here. This is from the Bangkok Post, so different source here. But a bunch of these. Quote, Joseph Jones, part-time worker at the Bessemer warehouse, said, "There are no weekly meetings to go over how you're feeling and how you're mentally handling the pandemic. But we have mandatory weekly meetings to go over how bad a union would be. It's almost like an abusive relationship where the abuser keeps saying, I'm sorry, don't go to the police. I will be better. We don't have to go to a third party." So that's some of the reporting on the ground. Bernie Sanders went down and said, quote, "It cannot be overstated how powerful it will be if Amazon workers in Alabama vote to form a union." The good news, I talked about the statistics before, this is from the NLRB. Once you get to an election, unions win about 2/3 of the time, right?
Cool.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it's about 50-50 from the filing of the petition, but that's because of the petitions that get dismissed or withdrawn because, you know, the NLRB will say, okay, well, yeah, the relevant bargaining unit is this huge group and the labor union is like, yeah, we're not going to go through that, or there's some other technical error. But no, when you look at over the last 10 years, unions win about twice as often as they lose when you go to a full election. So this is really, really interesting. It's really kind of on the forefront. And it helps, I think, flesh out that larger question of we have a public-facing fight for increasing the minimum wage and for having a living wage in this country. But you know, this goes to show that, like, living wage is not where the questions end. So, yeah, so that's up. Will Amazon employees become members of the retail, wholesale, and department store union? We will know in early April. So there you go.
Okay, just to clarify, though, Andrew, this is just at one specific Amazon location or whatever, like shipping something. It's not all across the United States.
Yeah, that is absolutely right. Really, really good question. This is about that particular Bessemer facility, the BHM1. Everybody, so we do not have closed shop unions in this country anymore. That means everybody gets an up or down vote on, will I be represented by this union? And so those 6,000 people, if they vote yes, then they will be represented in collective bargaining by the union. But the other 794,000.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah. But is it a roadmap for them? They kind of.
It's absolutely a roadmap, right? Okay. It says, yeah, we were able to break through this stranglehold. And then, you know, you would think enthusiasts of the free market would look and would say, like, well, are employees doing better off in Bessemer, Alabama, being represented by a collective bargaining unit? Or are they doing better off just, you know, one at a time, take it or leave it elsewhere in the country? And so in one of the salutary effects is that in trying to make the case, right? So Amazon is going to continue to have these meetings and, you know, the propaganda and everything else. But one of the things that's really beautiful about that is, suppose this union goes through in Alabama, and then there's an effort to unionize at another Amazon large fulfillment center. They'll roll out the same propaganda, and they will need to show that conditions at X facility are superior to conditions at the Bessemer facility, which often provides powerful incentives for internal change that sort of go beyond where their incentives are right now, which is Amazon changes things when they get enough bad press about, like, you know, how people are wearing diapers to work and that sort of thing. So I don't want to oversell what 6,000 people, and I'm really glad you asked the question that way, but it is a foot in the door. It is a roadmap for the future. And it would signal unions like, hey, you can get inside of Amazon. And that's a big thing.
All right. Well, that's exciting stuff. And let's see. I think you've left enough time for a mini wild card round.
Yeah,
so we've got some updates on the power sharing agreement.
So because I want to talk about committee assignments, I want to tell you that the power sharing arrangement that was entered, remember last time we talked about this, the text was embargoed in advance of the Senate consideration on impeachment. That's now out. It is Senate Resolution 27, and it is almost word for word identical to Senate Resolution 8 from 2001. And remember, that was an agreement that favored, quote unquote, the Republicans, right? That was George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney breaking the ties. And so, again, if you were skeptical, the Democrats got the exact same terms in the exact same words that the Republicans got for Trent Lott in 2001. I'm very, very pleased with this. I continue to think, I've said this before, the 2001 power sharing arrangement was only in effect for about 6 months because Jim Jeffords, Republican of Vermont, declared himself right, an independent and caucused with the Democrats, stopped caucusing with the Republicans, began caucusing with the Democrats. Lisa Murkowski has said she will not become a Democrat,
I'm not holding my breath on that one.
But that does not prevent her from becoming an independent and caucusing with the Democrats.
Then she goes straight to Bernie Sanders. It'd just be her and Bernie, and let's see, who else is technically independent? Is it just that? I feel like that guy from Maine, maybe?
Yeah, Angus King. Angus, yeah. good old Mainer name.
I feel like if you're going to join independents, join those two.
Go. Yeah, might as well go all the way to socialist. I'm with you. So in addition to Senate Res 27 that created the rules, Senate Res 28 staffed out those committees. And we have seen some of these reports, but I want to tell you, there are progressives everywhere in the power structure of the Senate. And the reason we haven't seen that so far is, again, the Senate's kind of busy with the impeachment thing right now. But listen to these folks. It's Sherrod Brown chairing the Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee. Maria Cantwell on Commerce, Science, and Transportation. Tom Carper on the Environment. Ron Wyden on Finance. Gary Peters, who is the junior senator from Michigan. I didn't know a whole lot about him, so I looked him up on Progressive Voters Guide, and they love this guy, right? He's the chair of the Homeland Security Committee. And if you're sitting there thinking like, okay, well, whatever, Kyrsten Sinema is on that committee, right? A moderate conservative Democrat from Arizona. She's way down the list, right? Like, so if you're sitting there thinking like, did Joe Biden, you know, kind of play pixies, choosies, like if you wanted to, you could have put Sinema as chair of Homeland Security, right? Like Michigan, not a lot of border crossings into Michigan. I read that as a pretty significant signal. And of course, you know, Bernie Sanders as chairman of the committee on the budget. Here are the negatrons. Here are the things you can be kind of mad at if you want. Amy Klobuchar. And again, we've been back and forth. Her voting record, I think, is more progressive than her campaign in 2020. Mm-hmm. But
yeah,
Amy Klobuchar chairs the Committee on Rules and Administration.
Not great. There goes the country. Yeah, I don't know what
that goes the country. Yeah. Mark Warner, pretty conservative, you know, moderate centrist Democrat, chairs the Intelligence Committee. Well,
but honestly, before you, I mean, even before you get into all this, there aren't even that many progressive senators to go around, you know? So it's not like, oh, a true progressive president would put AOC on the, it's like, well, you can't, there's only so many, the Bernies in the Senate. There's, you know, I mean, how much better could you do? Because you need a bunch of different senators chairing different things, right?
Some of them have interests that overlap. And, you know, so let me give you a really, really good example of that. I told you, Ron Wyden. And again, Ron Wyden, one of the 10 most progressive senators, you know, Democratic senators, and chairs the Finance Committee. Well, Elizabeth Warren kind of would like to also be on the Finance Committee, right? Mm-hmm. You could say, well, maybe we'll move her over to the Budget Committee, but Bernie Sanders is chairing the Budget Committee, right? So I think if you asked Elizabeth Warren, would you rather be on the Finance Committee and have the opportunity to shelter through the 2% wealth tax, right? Or would you rather be chairing the, let's say, the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources? Then she's probably going to take the former. And that would leave, again, you want to pick the worst one? There are only two that I think you could really make an issue about.
Well, and we're talking Democrats. The worst Democrat is Kirsten Sinema, in my opinion.
Yep.
So if she, what's she got? Anything?
Yeah, she is in the middle on Homeland Security.
Yeah, all right, fine.
She is on way down the list on banking, housing, and urban affairs. And she's way down the list on commerce, science, and transportation. So
what did Manchin get for his troubles?
Yeah, Joe Manchin is chairing the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources.
That kind of sucks.
I agree.
Hey, but that sounds like we are trying to set up future success by giving Joe Manchin what he might want.
Yep.
And that's how it goes when you don't get enough Democratic senators in the Senate. We got
Tom Carper chairs the Environment Committee, right? It's not like Manchin chairs the Environment Committee and is like, I love coal mine, right? Like,
oh, okay.
You can be angry about that one.
Honestly, can you? What else are we supposed to do? I mean, on one hand, who is going to criticize Democrats for trying to flatter Joe Manchin a little bit? That's our only chance of getting anything passed. Is there some other side that's like, no, you need to punish Manchin or something? I don't get what the alternative is.
I agree with that. And I would add the other folks on that committee are all folks who were chairing other committees, right? So the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources, Joe Manchin is the chair, but the additional members are Ron Wyden, Maria Cantwell, Bernie Sanders, Kirk Heinrich, Mazie Hirono, Angus King, Cortez Masto, Kelly, and Hickenlooper. So, you know, you also have some moderates on there, but there's not a great choice, right? Like, you can't chair multiple committees. Kirk Heinrich is slightly to the left of Joe Manchin, but that would be a huge slap in Joe Manchin's face, right? It's clear to me. He went to Chuck Schumer and said, I'd like to chair the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources, and they worked it out.
Like, yep, whatever you want, Buster. West Virginia gets what it wants right now. Have I mentioned how good looking you are, Mr. Manchin? Yeah, sure. Take your.
You want one other negatron? I'm a little bit negatron-y on. I have a man crush on Sheldon Whitehouse, and the judiciary is in order. Dick Durbin, who's 200, Pat Leahy, who's 200, Dianne Feinstein, who's 300, Sheldon Whitehouse, and then Klobuchar, Coons, Blumenthal, Hirono, Booker, Padilla, and John Ossoff got assigned to that to that committee. So, you know, like, the judiciary is a really, really important committee, and in an ideal world, right, I would rearrange that a little bit. But, you know, I mean, you can hear it, right? I'm nitpicking. This is, with the hand we were dealt, we are seeing, you know, if you're trying to figure out in an objective way. And look, I didn't get to do it on this show, but go listen to Clean Up on Aisle 45, episode number 3. Like, I rant about the guy that Joe Biden stuck on his commission on reforming the judiciary. I'm not afraid to call it out and tell you when I think Joe Biden is selling progressives down the river. If you were concerned about Biden and Schumer selling progressives down the river in terms of how they were allocating the Senate, this should make you feel good. This allocation is about as progressive as you could possibly do, and I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying is within the mathematically, this is like trying to arrange the tables at your wedding or something. You know, right. Like there's only so many combinations you can even do according to all these rules, and it's not like, well, why isn't Bernie Sanders at every table in every single position? Well, there's one of them. So there's only so much you can do.
And you're restricted. Yeah, you can only serve on two frontline committees and three totals. So, yeah.
Yeah. So I'd be open to hearing criticisms as long as people are like actually taking into account what could have been done. But, if you're just whining about it without at all taking into account the structure that has to be met, then it's not very valuable. But anyway, so that's cool. All right. Do we do it?
We've done it.
Squeeze it all in? Wow.
We did it.
Nice work. We've unionized Amazon and we've talked about the parent. So much accomplishment. We didn't even mention.
Once that thing is gone, it's like there's room to educate. It's just, I love it.
Yeah. That's a great description. You betray the law! Opening Arguments is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Finding great candidates to hire can be like trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along, which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OA. ZipRecruiter does the work for you. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, it gets sent out to over 100 top job sites with one click. Then, ZipRecruiter's matching technology finds people with the right skills and experience for your job and actively invites them to apply. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other services may overwhelm you with applications to sift through, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for, that needle in the haystack. In fact, ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OA. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OA. One more time, go to ZipRecruiter.com/OA. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
And thank you!
And now it's time to thank our top patrons, our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats over on Patreon.com/law. A weekly shout-out. No other shows do this, Andrew.
But yeah, it is just us. I don't even do this on my own show.
No.
Other show.
This is just us. We do this because, you know what? We signed a contract to our patrons years ago when we started this. And here we go. Tell Morgan G. Thompson. Still don't know what that means. Legal Eagle is so handsome. California Employment, Work, Accident, or Litigation. Call or text attorney David Nitka, 310-776-5879. Again, 310-776-5879. There you go. The Smiths. Oh, just without any apostrophes. Perfect. Biden borked the streak, October 23rd, 1987. Adam Borachoff. I feel like I've learned more about con law in the past year than I did during my con law class. A message to BK from his hometown in Blue, Georgia. Your tears of thwarted malevolence are clowning-horning delicious. Huh. Richard Scott. Jacob Daniel Murphy. Thomas's right-hand man, ad-lib masturbation joke. Daniel Lennon, please talk me out of running for office. No, maybe you should run for office. Sparkle Donkey votes for live show 2020 in Tequila, Jalisco, Mexico. You will supply the tequila. You supply the fabulous lesbians. Well, yeah, I don't know that we know where the fabulous lesbians live, but we'll see. Maybe there will be a live show in their area. I don't know. I don't know if it'll be in Mexico, though. We don't do a lot of Mexican law on this show, so it's not very... Anyway, rest in peace, Brandon Bernard. We must abolish the death penalty. The Coterie, business success with Salesforce. Find us at thecoterie.io. Justice for Beer. Check out Budget Botanist on Fiverr for all your virtual houseplant needs. Listening for years, still can't come up with something clever. Avril Parks, Savathan's OnlyFans. That's a weird symbols in there, so I don't know what that is. Wesley Glenn Brock, Chelsea Olsen, becoming a patron to get 5 episodes a week, and I finally caught up on months of backlog. New book, The Greatest Gift of All, Logical Path from Religion to Humanism by Mark McLean, out December 30th, pre-art. It's just out. It's already out. The Rudy Giuliani Center for Kids Who Can't Law Good and Want to Learn to Do Other Stuff Good, too. I Like My Pork Streaks, paired with At Casa Agria and App Emperor's Brewery Beer. Big Docket Energy, No Atheists in Fox News Hole. It's a weird one. Diane Resignstein. Yeah, no kidding. She needs to resign. He also needs to retire is Justice Breyer as well within these next 2 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
GD Tree says Oracle of Seasons is a strong contender for third or fourth best Zelda game. Thomas Kleberg, Legal Eagle getting a YouTube copyright strike over the B-movie is the low-stakes legal drama we need. Buddy Hoomstev Geyerson. One is first, but two is a close second. Idea for a screenplay, Air Bud, man's best amicus. It's pronounced Hadron, not Hadron. Okay, fair point. How about T3B Gate Episode 2, Andrew Strikes Back? Coming out as trans to my employer shortly after this episode records. Wish a girl some clownhorning luck. Ooh, wow. Yeah, I hope that goes
good
okay.
Luck. Good luck. Yeah.
Two fabulous lesbians who totally posted the name of the cutest, fluffiest, most fabulous puppy in the world, and it's Lily.
Woo!
Edgy Veggie. One smart cookie scent cutters. Or man, what's with all the symbols in this export? It's not working well. Sorry. Bob Newhouse, sassy Italy tours, thinks OA must record a show from a from the balcony overlooking our favorite Piedmont vineyard when this is all over. Totally agree. Spring Brewstein, Jennifer Chikowski, A Republic if you can keep it. GME stock to the moon. Good luck with that. Greg Kreimer, a string of unconstitutional laws. Mike Hall, maybe if we just call that place Dakota Tur again, they will stop sending people to D.C. Say it with me, amicus. Flufftastic, Torsten Peel of the Satanic Temple. Yes, I'm not even a tortfeasor and I'm kicking your ass. Angry Macface. Sorry, Andrew, Uncle Frank is too far gone. The Legend of Zelda is older than John Ossoff and 12 representatives. Good. Penelope is ranting about Terpsichore's cryptography. The Books That Burn podcast, reviewing fictional depictions of trauma since 2019. Well, you can review that bar question. It's a lot of work coming up with clever patron names. This group is really impressive. Simple Country Hyper Chicken. Who is bigger, Mr. Bigger or Mr. Bigger's baby? The baby is a little bigger and uses rugged rubber baby buggy bumpers. Okay. Can't believe I got something on the whiteboard. Ooh. Uzi Rudy's Legal Ruse movie was a doozy. Murray Gregerson. Wilma Fisfitz O'Neely. Change my Patreon name so that I don't jump every time you read it. Crazy Corgi, obedience to the law is demanded as a right, not asked as a favor. Beyond Meat the Streak, I move for a bad court thingy. I heard a rumor that Ted Cruz pees his pants on purpose because he likes the form feeling against his legs. United States versus 43 and a half gross dead parrots. A Link to the Past is definitely the third best Zelda game. Wow, a lot of people getting in the Zelda game. I hope you're on the stream, by the way. If you're into these Zelda game rankings, you know, twitch.tv/srsnes. Got some Zelda maybe coming at you today. I don't know, tomorrow.
Oh, and that is a lot of fun. So, absolutely.
And the talk about a pork test. Original Zelda Second Quest is porked. That's more porked than this bar exam. Seattle Pete. Brent Medling, I became a patron because this is the best podcast ever. Jake, I apologize for never changing my Patreon name, Seymour Butts. Exceeding the speed limit is breaking the law. Stop breaking the law, assholes. Christopher Brown, ask a question that the cat lawyer would ask. Nice. Lawful Copter says, Thomas and Andrew, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for everything you guys do. You've encountered a CR28 T3B question. Everyone roll for initiative. The wheels of justice turn faster than the speed I changed my Patreon name. There's a goat. Why is there a goat? Andrew Seidel's butt is in favor of the poop loophole. Odin the Law Dog, Circle, Robert M. Voirdier Straits, the Sultans of Suing. Clean up on aisle 45 is an anagram of a spinoff to relieve lunacy. Wow. If nice. You spell out the 45, apparently that's true.
That's awesome. Cool. By the way.
A spinoff to relieve lunacy. Yeah, you did
that's,
it.
That's fantastic. By the way, Sultans of Suing is an A+ pun. Like that is nice. Really, really good.
Yeah, because a dire strait, like Vordir Straits, good stuff. Josh Hoku, yeah. Check out Ring Runner and Brigador on Steam, two slightly mad indie labors of love that do not deserve their obscurity. And your turn, Andrew.
And thank you to Polly Hernandez. Hey, everybody, we're all going to get laid, which is just fantastic quote. The CEO of Antifa, join our leadership call this Sunday. Emily Rainbow Spence, a concluded celebratory gathering of lawyers, is an ex parte. Jason Kopus, hot spear suggests Biden pardon a nonviolent drug offender every day until Republicans agree to limit the president's pardoning power. Whatever happened to Michael Avenatti? I'm here live. I'm not a cat. I won't commit perjury. Two fabulous thespians, proud supporter of Antifa LLC, a Maryland limited liability corporation. Don't make me a liar. GiveToModestNeeds.org. 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 Not that Chris Wallace. Nate Drex, Darth Mandy Pants, F the Clown Horns. That's pretty good. Optimism is overrated. No, it isn't. Petition to convert the T3BE suit into a class action. This set makes me feel dumb, and I need some feelings relief. Well, hopefully you got it right this week. 13th century Saxony gravel truck lawyer. I am the bad things that happen in Philadelphia. Stay gritty. Diogenes the Cynic was right. Dude. Jeff Kelback, Jennifer Kratch, don't take legal advice from a cannibal. The ex parte parrot is just sleeping. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. Ever so slightly hopeful that we can have nice things again. You should be. John Bilderbeck, Stephen Balticate Sandoval. There's no rule that says a lawyer can't be a cat on Zoom. Philip Kaiser, Andrea, the arbitrary and capricious, Alfred Wallace. You tell me the definition of a sandwich, and I'll tell you if a Crunchwrap. Yeah, Crunchwrap is a sandwich. Sonic and Knuckles. I've heard a dress sing, but I've never heard a crunch rap. Absion, Payne's Trumpet, Trambolus, let me be slightly more explicit because I like being slightly more explicit. Speaking of being more explicit, no, I can't read that on the air. Jonathan, Trump wanted four seasons, got Doubletree. I am going to have to wear, by the way, Thomas, I got my sister got me a Lawn and Order t-shirt for Christmas, so I'll have to wear that during our next Q&A. In the karaoke system, the people are represented by two parties, the songs and the karaoke legends who sing them. Dun-dun! That's disgraced former President Trump to you, Bob. Milo, Meadsong, Esquire, Halfling, Bard, and Attorney at Law. The Harangutang and the Howler Monkeys will go down in history as the worst administration ever. Join your labor union. Well, like this episode. Thank you, Biden, for revoking EOs 138, 36, 37, and 39. The devil went down to Georgia looking for a vote to steal. That's been a while. Marianne Pippin, James K. My face when I think I finally came up with a clever name, but it is read wrong and no one gets it. I'm sorry. Chad T. Anonymous, with no irony at all. They want the impeachment tossed for lack of standing. WordOrigins.org, your source for legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Two fabulous ex-parrots. Therese Chan, R.I.P. Notorious RBG. Ba weep grana weep ninny bong. I have a mask with that on it, which you may or may not have seen. Wear a mask, wash your hands, watch your distance, welcome the vaccine. They said I could be anything, so I became two fabulous lesbians. Derek, Big Easy Blasphemy, it's kind of nice having a competent federal government again. SummitShuffleboard.com. A string of unpronounceable characters, RondaTheDork.com. Have you been there yet? I haven't checked that out yet. Andrew is my favorite Thomas's co-host. Aaron is a close second. Well, I think we can all agree on that one. Malaika Chandler, Tricicular Manslaughter, Soggy Pants, Adam Costa, Matthew Vernon, Buttercup's Legal Services doesn't have a joke this week, but will purr if you bring Morgan on more. We all love Morgan. We know that. And I have a Morgan-specific episode that is being cooked up, so you might get your wish. Jay Aldenwalt, AG has been invading all my favorite podcasts. I love it. How do we get her on the next Hardcore History? Sakishite Fukusumi, I guess there isn't really much going on this week, so I'd better give you a nice long Patreon name to read. Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. De jury belly at Pacquis at last, baby. Heather L. Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium. Ian and Allie. Danny Rosari. Eli Bosnick. David in Brooklyn. Nuts and Bolts. Sam Danow. Mitchell. No commute, so behind on podcasts. If the law isn't on your side, quote some random poetry about sailing. I agree with that 100%. Natasha Crunchwrap wants you to support the Justice Policy Institute. Sam Buck. And our all-time great, he who shall never be overthrown, Conrad Michaels.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam. No kidding.
All right, it's T3B answer time. Let's stick my finger in the wind and see how the porkage is looking on this test. A challenging question, but I don't know that I would say unfair. Let's see how I did. Probably not well.
All right, Thomas, this was about domestic abuse, right? And it was father lives with the son. The son is an alcoholic. Whenever he gets drunk, the son becomes violent and physically abuses the father. One night, father hears his son out on the front stoop making what are described as loud, obscene remarks. Father, certain that the son is drunk again and that he's going to get beaten, then barricades both of the front door, takes out a gun. The son discovers that that's going on and beats down the front door, kicks it down. And as he bursts through the front door, the father shot him 4 times in the chest, killing him. We then learn, stipulated by the question, that the son was not, in fact, drunk and was not
and under
the influence of
alcohol. And somehow
we learn
that he didn't intend to harm his father.
Or any drug and did not intend to harm his father. Yeah, that's just, you know, we can't. I mean, that's a bar exam kind of
sure,
yeah. Take that issue off the table. So then the father presents the above facts and asks the judge to instruct the jury on self-defense. How should the judge instruct the jury with respect to self-defense? So there are really 2 questions that you need to figure out here. The first is, when do judges instruct juries, give jury instructions, right? And then the second is this an appropriate situation, right? So we have give the self-defense instruction because it expresses the defense's theory of the case. That was your choice, A. B, we have give the self-defense instruction because the evidence is sufficient to raise the defense. Mm. And then we have 2 different deny because the father was not in imminent danger, or deny because the father used excessive force. And you were between A and D. Your deny was D. So first, let's talk a little bit about what jury instructions are. Remember that in a trial, the judge is the gatekeeper for the law, right? The jury gets to decide the facts. And so when you have a law that is contingent upon certain facts, a jury instruction tells the jury what they have to find, right? They will say, okay, if you want to find negligence, you must find that the defendant failed to abide by the standard of care appropriate in X circumstances. And so that lets the jury know, okay, we're finding a fact, and how do we then translate that fact into what our verdict needs to be? And so here, the question is, right, what would the jury instruction be on self-defense? That instruction would be, you have the right to use deadly force against someone if they have their 4 elements. 1, attacked you in an unprovoked way. 2, that threatens your imminent injury. 3, that you have used an objectively reasonable degree of force in response. And 4, that you had an objectively reasonable fear of injury or death. The C and D, I think, I don't know that they really got it that right. Like, I guess you were correct that the question is, well, you know, is it an imminent danger because he was not in fact drunk? No, I mean, the guy's kicking down your door, right? That is sufficient to cause an objectively reasonable fear of injury
or
death.
That's what I thought. That's why I got rid of C.
Yep. Particularly when coupled with the past history of abuse. Yeah. This is somebody who beats the clown horn out of you all the time. It's reasonable to think they're going to do that again. And then, was it excessive force? You sort of paused over this. And I agree that, like, if you're thinking about the deny elements, that the excessive force is probably the most one.
Yeah, but like, he didn't give any warning. He didn't do it, you know, like.
Yeah, you don't have to. There is no, okay. When you're inside your house, there is no duty to retreat, right? You can use whatever force is appropriate.
What happens when you share a house with someone?
Yeah, well, no, that's that was the case here. But
exactly. But that's why I asked the question.
Right? So both people would have, if they were the victim of the attack, would have no duty to retreat. They could, okay. Stand your ground. In the bar exam, when you would look for evidence that the force, the use of force was unreasonable, you would look for something like the father fired four times into the chest, and then, you know, the son turned and ran and the father followed after him and fired three more shots or something like that, right?
It's hard to know what in America is considered excessive force, but I hear you.
That's how the bar exam would suggest that it's excessive.
Gotcha. This is a longer answer than my guess.
Then the question is just, does the defense always get to raise self-defense?
So are you eliminating D? So is D a good one?
So C and D are both out. Yeah. C and D are both out.
Oh, okay. It's, God damn it. It's going to be B.
So between A and B, the question is, do you always get to raise self-defense? Yeah. Or do you have to show sufficient evidence? And unfortunately, it's a B.
Yeah, okay. I thought about that after. I was like, yeah, no, maybe that is. Because it does leave... Does make sense that it's like, well, you can't raise it just in any abstract situation. There has to at least be some level of evidence sufficient.
Yeah, and think about it. That's right, because giving the jury instruction carries with it certain connotations, right? Like we would, even in civil cases, we would argue about this all the time in terms of jury instructions of like, oh, if you say you may find that the plaintiff had contributory negligence because X, right? Well, once you say that, then they get to debate over it, right? If you don't say that there will be contributory negligence, right, then the jury is unlikely to come up with that on their own.
Yeah, I could have gotten this one. Another challenging one. I looked at the back, like the downside, but I didn't look at the other side of it. Like there, So B, okay, I get it. All right.
So how are we feeling? Non-porked?
This is a fair question. This is a challenging question. It feels like I could possibly get most of these if I do just the right amount of reasoning, just the right, you know. It kind of depends on how many, if all of them are this hard. This feels like a challenging question to me, honestly, like not knowing the law. But, I don't... Seems like I could have gotten there. We'll see. There's no way you can know whether or not a test is porked by looking at one question.
Oh, it's more about like totally.
the last test was porked because all 10 questions were impossible. They were all the hardest kind of bar questions. There were no freebies. And so I feel like I went with the freebie answer again here, because in the past it's done me okay. Like I've, you know, just like, oh well, you get to raise it because it's your theory of the case. Bada bim, bada bo, you know, no reasoning. And that hasn't gotten me an answer in a very long time. So maybe I need to stop doing that. But again, we're changing tests, so it's hard to know. But anyway, all right. I didn't get it. Let's find out who this week's big winner is, though.
All right, Thomas. Well, a bit of a timely and possibly bittersweet T3BE winner. But the first one I saw get it right on Twitter was Nick Jordan. That is at NJordan79, who writes, answer B, there has to be some evidence to support self-defense claims. Answer A would mean the judge always gives the instruction, even if you beat a cop to death with an American flag while storming the Capitol. Yeah, so congratulations on being first past the post, Nick. Everyone, give Nick a follow. That is at NJORDAN79 on Twitter. And congratulations, Nick, I think, on being this week's winner.
What an episode. Nice job.
Woo!
That's our show. Can't wait for another Rapid Response Friday. And if you need more OA in your veins before then, make sure to grab that Stereo app. Listen to us every Wednesday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. That includes this Wednesday, because every Wednesday includes every Wednesday. So we'll see you then.
Until then.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.